You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by TechServe. TechServe is having an e-waste recycling event created to help keep hazardous materials out of landfills by recycling electronics. Saturday, July 10th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on 23rd Street near 6th Avenue. Info at techserve.com/recycling. Welcome to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host, and we are broadcasting live from the hand-built radio station of Heritage Radio Network behind Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick on this very, very hot New York summer night. So last week's show, if you were listening, was all about cold, refreshing beverages to help get you through nights like this or days like this in New York. I think it was like 102 today, something like that, which is not normal for New York. We get them occasionally. Last year, it hardly even broke 90. This year's been bad. So last week, anyway, I was talking about iced coffee and iced tea and how they are the godsend, life-saving beverages of summer. And after I did the show, I was talking to my sister, and she said, "What did you do your show on?" And I said, "Iced tea and iced coffee." And she said, "Oh, you talked about Vietnamese iced coffee, right?" Oh, I can't believe I forgot to talk about Vietnamese iced coffee. I mean, I cannot believe that I forgot to mention one of the most refreshingly delicious, crack-like, addictive beverages ever created by human hands. Vietnamese iced coffee. I don't know how I forgot it. I think I was in such a fog from the heat, and I'm working too much, I'm teaching too much. I don't know what's going on, but I left it out. And I mean, I'm sure I talked about it on previous shows earlier in the year because I've been to Vietnam twice in the past year. But I don't know, to not include it in the show that was devoted exclusively to its ilk is unthinkable. So now that it's 100 degrees again in New York, like, that's all I can think about is Vietnamese iced coffee. The sweet, thick slurp of that magical Southeast Asian drink. It's all I want, except for maybe beer. Maybe I want beer instead. You know, it's a toss-up. Anyway, so we have to give a little bit of time on this week's show devoted to Vietnamese iced coffee. And then we'll get to the subject of this week's show, which is about cooking in clay ovens. Totally unrelated, because I did that this weekend. But anyway, if you've never had Vietnamese iced coffee, I can't imagine there's anyone out there who has not. But if you haven't, you really are missing something, because it's like this perfect drink. You know, of course, we all know from history that the French colonized Indochina, Vietnam, and they were there for a really long time. And they brought their coffee culture with them. And coffee is grown in Vietnam, but I don't think it was really grown much until the French came in. And they introduced coffee drinking. And also because the French like their dairy products, but they were in this very hot country with no dairy cattle and not much refrigeration, they brought canned milk there with them, sweetened, condensed canned milk. And so over the course of history, this, you know, cafe au lait culture morphed into this iced drip coffee over sweetened condensed milk drink culture. And, you know, I think it's one of the good legacies of colonialism. There aren't too many good legacies of colonialism in the world, but I have to say this iced coffee is definitely one of them. So they make these little steel filter contraptions. You can get them to fit over one cup, or you can get much bigger ones, and you put the coffee in it and you sort of screw down this metal filter thing inside, and then you pour boiling water over it, and you can drink it hot. Certainly it's good hot, but you know, in a place like Vietnam where it's 98 degrees every day, you generally would want to drink it iced. And so the little filter thing sits over this glass with ice in it, and the coffee drips down, and under the ice is this big blob of sweetened condensed milk. And so the coffee, like, sort of drips slowly down over the ice and into the milk. And then when it's finished, you stir it up. And then you're supposed to sit there, you know, just in a cafe with all the motor scooters going by and all the chaos and all the noise, and drink it really, really slowly. And I can't do that. I cannot drink it slowly. It's so good and it's so tiny. Like all food in Asia, it's tiny. And I'm an American and I'm trying to train myself to drink things more slowly and eat more slowly, but you just have to suck it down. You have to slurp it. And I would sit there with my friend Trum, who she's from Vietnam, and she was one of our translators for the organization that I work for. And we would sit, and we would meet for coffee almost every day because she loves coffee, and we would get a chance to talk, and she's a great person. And so we would meet almost every day for coffee, and she could make one last for like a half an hour, like one little tiny glass of coffee. It has probably 3 ounces in it. Oh, Trum can sit there taking her tiny little sips for half an hour. I would just chug the whole thing in one gulp. So finally, I was looking around one day, and I saw that people were drinking much taller versions of the coffee. We were drinking café soda, which means coffee with milk and ice. And I said, what is that? Why is that taller? And Trump said, oh, that's Café Saigon. That's different. I'm like, well, what is it? And she said, nothing. It's just bigger and taller because people from Saigon are richer. They're from the city. They have more money. And so they can order bigger coffee. And I said, well, sign me up. I want Café Saigon. So I finally figured it out. It took me, you know, 2 month-long trips to figure it out. But that's what I started ordering, which was my Café Saigon. So if you find yourself in Vietnam or even in a Vietnamese restaurant or cafe here in the States and you want the tall coffee, you get the Café Saigon, not the Café Soda. Although I guess the Café Saigon, you could order it hot or iced too. So you'd have to say Café Saigon Soda. Anyway, you're probably better off just asking somebody who really speaks Vietnamese, not somebody like me who speaks like 5 words of Vietnamese. Anyway, I just had to get that out there because I felt like such an idiot for doing a whole show on iced coffee and iced tea. And I talked about Thai iced tea, but I didn't talk about Vietnamese iced coffee. So there you go. It's done. Anyway, yesterday I was driving home from the long holiday weekend. I went up to New Hampshire to visit my friend Lori, who has this unbelievably great house in New Hampshire that she built herself, which I'll get to a little later. Anyway, we were driving home and we, you know, got on the highway to get in the car for the long drive home. And so, of course, you need your big ice cold beverage. So we stopped at Dunkin' Donuts to get coffee. Not a place I would normally patronize, except when I'm on the road and there are no other options. So I go to Dunkin' Donuts and, of course, you know, you see the prices and you're totally suckered and you say, well, you know, the small is $1.75 and the medium is $1.85. And look, the large is only a quarter more, $2.15 or whatever. And so you get the large. So, of course, I ordered a large. And it was literally like a half a gallon of iced coffee. I don't go to places like that much. And so it seems like every time I go, they've increased the sizes. Like, I remember being in high school when the Big Gulp came out and it was, you know, whatever, 24 ounces. And it was gigantic. And then when I was in a 7-Eleven not that long ago, and I looked, and the Big Gulp is like 128 ounces now or something. It's like a milk gallon jug. Where are people putting all that liquid? Anyway, so of course I fell right into that trap that I'm always raging so loudly against, which is, you know, supersizing and the allure of quantity over quality, which makes me insane, and I can't believe I fell for it. But I did, and it was really hot out, and when it was going to be a six-hour trip, and so I decided to get the largest one, but it was decaf, because I know myself. And of course, I drank it all within the first 2 hours. And did you know that there is not a single rest stop on all of Interstate 95 from White River Junction, Vermont, all the way to Hartford, Connecticut? At least going southbound, there isn't. I found that out yesterday. So, a word of warning, if you go for the supersize, there are no rest stops. So, we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll talk about some other things. We'll be right back.
I believe in brain days. Brain days. Brain days. I believe in brain days. Brain days. Brain days. I believe in brain days.
listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by TechServe. TechServe is having an e-waste recycling event Saturday, July 10th from 10 to 4 on 23rd Street near 6th Avenue. More information at techserve.com/recycling. Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network and Why We Cook. I'm your host, Erica Weitz. So I was talking about Vietnamese iced coffee in the last segment because last week's show was about iced coffee and iced tea, and I had forgotten to mention it. And I know I keep saying that tonight's show isn't about this, that it's actually about cooking in clay ovens, but I'm getting to that. A couple things I just remembered since we were talking about, well, I was talking about Vietnamese iced coffee, is that there's also a couple of other weird coffee beverages in Vietnam that that you can find if you really look. There's this one thing they make where they take egg yolks and whisk them up with sugar till it's like a really, really thick sort of foam. Like if you were making a sabayon, which is a sauce, you mix egg yolks and sugar up until it's really, really thick. And then that gets whisked with coffee and it gets drunk. And they're raw egg yolks, but you whisk it up with sugar and then some hot coffee and whip it all up. And you drink that and it's sort of like liquid tiramisu in a way without the alcohol or the chocolate. It's a little too rich for me, but it's sort of an interesting idea. I mean, that's got to come from the French, from the whole sabayon thing. But it's not really my scene. It's too much. And then there's also this coffee bean that's sold in Vietnam that it's still on the bush. It gets eaten by weasels. And the weasels eat the coffee bean and then they digest it and then they poop it out. And then the farmers collect the weasel poop and pick the coffee beans out of the weasel poop. And then the coffee is sold and it's very highly prized and much more expensive. And I've never had it, but maybe next time I'm going back, probably in the fall, I'll have it then. And did you know that Vietnam is the world's second largest coffee producer now after Brazil? Who knew, right? Okay, anyway. So I was in New Hampshire, as I was saying, and I went to visit my friend Lori. And she lives in a house that is a straw bale house that she built herself. And if you've never heard of that, straw bale construction is actually this really, really amazing thing where you basically take a bale of hay, you know, a bale of straw, really tightly bound bale of straw, and you smear it all over with clay and sand to like seal it up. And then you use it to build the walls of your house and they get stacked together and they put like metal ratcheting strips around them and use a machine to pull down and press them really tightly into each other and really compact. And you get this like indestructible fireproof temperature controlled house that costs almost nothing to make because it's made out of straw. Pretty cool, right? And it stays really cool inside in the summer and really warm inside of the winter because the straw insulates the house so well. And so we were there and my brother-in-law was there and he's an architect. And I was like, who invented this? Where did it come from? And he said that when Scandinavian immigrants first came to the U.S., they were building their houses out of sod, out of turf, like out in the prairie. Basically, prairie grasses are so deeply rooted and the roots get so matted together that it creates this impermeable turf mesh. And so the Scandinavian settlers would go and they would cut these big chunks of sod out of the prairie and they'd build their houses like that. But it takes thousands of years for that turf to build up. And so once they cut up all the sod from the prairie, it was all gone. And they couldn't build their houses out of it anymore, so they started instead creating these straw bales to, like, simulate the sod, and that's where it came from. Anyway, her house that she built herself is beautiful, and right near, like, hiking trails, and it's right on a lake, and it's so nice, and the weather was cool, and we had a great time, and there was a whole bunch of us. And if that's not enough, that she has a beautiful house on a lake near hiking trails in the White Mountains, she had also just finished building a clay wood-fired outdoor bread oven. I mean, it's not enough. You live in this great house out in the woods, and then you have this oven, too. So we started really playing around with it, and there's all this stone. You know, New Hampshire is the granite state, And so everywhere you look is granite, and there's great stones everywhere. So she built the oven on a base of big granite, like on boulders. I don't know if they're granite, actually, but on stones. And then on top of that, laid an oven floor out of fireproof brick. And then the way you do it is you then mound up sand into a dome, and you pat the sand really firmly into like a beehive shape, and then put the clay over it. And so you smear the clay all over the sand, and then the clay hardens, and then you basically just dig out all the sand, and you're left with this dome. And that's the oven. And then you fire it up. You put wood inside, and you fire it up, and the wood fires up the clay, and it hardens, and you keep firing it up for a couple days to dry it out and harden the clay, and then you have an oven. Or at least I think that's how it's made. I was looking at the book that she had, and I may not have gotten all the steps right. So if I'm wrong, please let me know. You can, you know, go to the Why We Cook Facebook page and let me know. But anyway, so when we got there, she had just started baking off her first pizzas and had some bread dough rising. And so we ate a little bit of the pizza, and it was pretty good. But, you know, the oven wasn't fully dried out enough, so you weren't getting that really intense heat, dry heat yet that you need to make a good pizza dough. So I wanted to kind of, you know, get my hand in there and try it out. And so basically I spent the entire weekend building fires and then making dough and cooking off various food items in that oven, and which was great because I love making fires, and I was totally in heaven. First of all, I never really get to cook, even though I'm a chef and I'm a chef instructor. I rarely actually get to cook, and I never get to build fires and cook over fires except my little gas grill that I have in the country. But that's not really like cooking over a fire. That's like you turn on the gas and you light a match. That's cheating. So not only was there this wood oven, but Lori also has this fire pit in the ground next to it. And so the first thing Saturday morning, we got up and she said, build a fire in the pit and build a fire in the oven, and let's, you know, fire them both up and keep going. So that's what we did. What we wanted to dry out the clay still some more in the oven and keep the fire in the pit going so we'd have burning coals to keep chucking in the oven all day. So we did that, and then we went off and went hiking and went swimming and had a great old time. And then we came back in the afternoon and, you know, opened up some beer and really got the oven fired up. And since we were 300 miles north of New York, it wasn't that hot. It wasn't like it was here. So it was cool enough that you could basically stand in front of this clay oven and cook all evening. So that first night we got the oven really raging, and I had brought up some little fingerling potatoes, and so we tossed those with some herbs right from her garden and some olive oil and threw those in there and roasted them. And then I had brought up also some lamb racks, so I trimmed those up and I picked a bunch of herbs, some pesto, you know, basil, mint. I pureed those with garlic and some honey and some breadcrumbs and made like a paste. So I put these lamb racks in the oven and gave them a good sear in the oven first while it was still really hot. We were having a little trouble keeping the temperature kind of regulated, but I got the lambs in there and roasted them off and then spread them with this pesto that I made right before they came out. And so the pesto just cooked a little bit. I just wanted to take the raw edge off of the garlic. And it's great because anything that you cook in that oven actually picks up flavor from the clay. It was really interesting because she gave me some bread the first night that had been in there. And I said, wow, that tastes like it has za'atar on it. And za'atar is this Middle Eastern herb mixture that's made from thyme and sumac. I said, oh, you put za'atar on the bread. She said, no, it was just salt and pepper. And I was like, really? It tastes like you have something else on there. And she said, no, that's the taste of the oven. You're actually picking up flavor from the clay. Things come out of this oven tasting kind of Moroccan or Middle Eastern, which is kind of cool. So the lamb and the potatoes definitely picked up those flavors, and they came out great, like really juicy. I didn't even have to sear the lamb first. You just like blast it with this heat, and it came out great. And then there was also some whole wheat bread dough that she had made, and that was kind of just rising all day. And there were a lot of us around, and we were having a good time. We were really, really busy. So Lori shaped the dough and then put it on the peel and left it out for final rise, and then we all kind of went off to watch fireworks after dinner and forgot all about the bread. So when we came back late at night, I saw the dough still sitting there. So I took it outside to the oven, and the oven was still really hot because it retained so much heat, even though the fire, you know, was gone. The oven was super hot, so I slid the dough in the oven, and in about 30 minutes it was baked. It was great. And I took it out, and it had this really nice brown crust, and it had a good crumb inside, and the bottom was nice and snappy when you tapped on it. So I just put it aside to cool. I had to keep everybody off of it. Set it aside to cool, and we ate it for breakfast the next day, and it was really good. And, you know, most bread will taste better a few hours after you bake it. Anyway, it kind of needs time to cool down, and the flavors have to develop. You shouldn't really eat bread right out of the oven. I mean, except pizza. But regular breads actually benefit from sitting for a couple hours. So I let it sit overnight. We ate it for breakfast, and it was great. So we have to take another short break. And when we come back, more tales from the oven. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by TechServe. So if you're a fan of Why We Cook, you should let me know that you're a fan by finding the show on Facebook. Just search Facebook, Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network, and become a fan and say hi and let me know what you think of the show. You can also leave comments on the HeritageRadioNetwork.com website, Why We Cook page, and let me know what you think. I'd love to hear from you. And anytime you have any questions, comments, you can always email the show, or you can leave a comment on the page and let me know what you think. So anyway, so I've been talking about how I was in New Hampshire this weekend visiting my friend who had built this clay oven, this outdoor, like, kind of dome-shaped clay oven. Everyone always says beehive-shaped clay oven, but as a beekeeper, I can tell you, no beehives are shaped like beehives. Beehives are shaped like boxes. They look like apartment buildings for bees. Nobody uses that beehive shape anymore, which is too bad because it's kind of this beautiful, iconic shape. But there are no more beehives like that because to get the honey out, you have to destroy those. That's another show. We'll talk about beekeeping one day. Anyway, so on Sunday, we made pizza. So I made some pizza dough. My 10-year-old niece was with us, and she was like, pizza! So we made some pizza dough, and I kept it really slack. You know, if you when you get a really good pizza like you get here at Roberta's, the dough has really big bubbles in it, those nice big air pockets. That's from moisture. You always want to make bread doughs, pizza doughs, a lot wetter than you actually think you can even handle them. Most people get a little freaked out when they're making dough, and they get afraid of it sticking and they add too much flour. But you shouldn't be afraid of sticky dough. It's better. So I kept it really slack and I let it proof, you know, I let it rise and kind of took my time with it. And then, you know, at dinner time we were ready to go. So I portioned it out and I stretched it out. And one of the things I really like about Lori is that she just, if she needs a tool, you know, she'll just make it. So she had just built this oven. She didn't have a true pizza peel yet. The peel is what you use to slide dough into the oven. So she just had this piece of lumber. She's like, here. And it was painted on one side, but it was unfinished on the other. So we just used this long piece of lumber, and it worked fine, this thin plank. And that was the peel. And so I patted out the dough, and I took some of that leftover pesto from the lamb from the night before and a chunk of gorgonzola that I had brought up and some herbs and crumbled that all over. And it was great. Threw them in the oven, blasted them in there for a couple minutes. They came out great. But one thing you have to do is make sure that the floor of the oven is free from ash and sand before you put the dough in there. And I did try. I mean, we brushed it all away, and then you're supposed to use like an old rag dipped in water and kind of swab the floor of the oven. And I did that, but the pizza had a little bit of grit on the bottom. It was a little bit ashy, but it was kind of good. I mean, in a way, the ash and the sand kind of added to the rustic charm of the pizza. So anyway, it was really good. And then there were still some lamb racks left. We had a lot of lamb. So I cooked those off too in there. But by then, the fire was starting to die down because it was a little tricky to control the heat in there. But luckily, we had this raging fire in the pit that had now died down to these coals that I feel like we could have like forged iron over this other fire. It was so hot. So she took this old grill kind of grid out, put it over that fire. And then I took the lamb racks and I threw them on that and kind of charred them over these coals. And that really was great because it just crisped up the fat and it just kind of like singed the fat a little bit. And the lamb was really juicy and it was great. And then she had also cooked off some ribs inside in the oven. And so then we put those over the charring embers. And she had made this great glaze with Thai chilies and some brown sugar and stuff. And the glaze just kind of caramelized. And it was great. It was a great meal. And it really, like, you know, brought me back to, like, it was like a real joy of cooking kind of situation. Like, I was squatting by an open fire, cooking big chunks of meat. You know, very manly kind of thing. But, you know, the name of this show is Why We Cook. And if you listened to the first episode I ever did, it was really about the reason why we cook is because we as humans harnessed fire. And we figured out that if we put our food into the fire and cooked it, not only would it taste a lot better, but it would give us a lot more nutrition and give us a lot more protein so that we could grow our brains a lot bigger and we could rise to the top of the food chain and conquer the world and then subsequently destroy it. But nonetheless, the reason why we cook is because we harness the ability to control fire. And sitting out there this weekend, either standing in front of this clay oven or squatting over this pit, really kind of brought me back to that and reminded me of how primal and how simple cooking can be. And while I was doing this, my brother-in-law, who, like I said, is an architect, landscape architect, was telling me about one of his private clients who lives in this like $40 million mansion on Long Island that they've been landscaping for like 5 years now, and how he wants an outdoor kitchen now, and how they've been pricing out outdoor pizza ovens for this guy. And they're, you know, they're thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to put in this really fancy outdoor kitchen. And I was like, you don't need that. Just dig a hole in the ground or make a big pile of sand and cover it in mud. And that's how people have done it for thousands and thousands of years. You don't need to spend all this money. So I felt kind of smug, which I like once in a while. But I also just really enjoyed the process. It had been a long time since I had gotten really like dirty and sweaty and messy and really into it, like up to my elbows in ashes and grease. And once in a while, you just have to get dirty in order to get fed. And that's what I did. So that takes us right up to the end here. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to the show tonight. And next week's episode will be my 50th episode of Why We Cook. So I'm planning something really big. I don't know what it is yet, but you should stay tuned for the 50th anniversary episode of Why We Cook. It'll be next Tuesday night, live at 6:30. And you can always listen to these shows on iTunes. You can subscribe to the podcast. So thanks to Nat and Jack in the control room, and we'll see you next week.